Appeals, and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everybody. We will proceed to case number one, please. The United States versus Thomas J. Summer.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Matt Vaughn. I've been appointed to represent the defendant, Thomas J. Sumner. Simply put, this is a case that should probably not be before this court. As this panel is aware, this is the second time this matter has been heard in this court. For the second time, a relatively narrow sentencing issue is before the court, and we submit that had the trial court followed the plain language of this court's previous decision, and had the trial court follow the plain language of a 1998 decision from this court, United States versus Weiss, there would be no need for the present appeal. As this court may recall, this defendant originally in January 2000 pled guilty to three counts of distribution of powder cocaine. This conduct for which the defendant was found guilty occurred in September of 1999. The charged conduct represented 9.4 grams of powder cocaine, which under the sentencing guidelines would have given this defendant a sentence of 8 to 14 months in the Bureau of Prison.
But of course, as you are well aware, the relevant conduct provisions of the guidelines very often have the effect of sentencing people for more than simply the offense of conviction. My concern about your argument based on Weiss is that our remand was a targeted remand. We didn't just send the case back. It was very specific as to the instructions. And it was done after careful analysis of waiver versus forfeiture. And since we found that the point had been forfeited, isn't it appropriate for the district court, not just permissible, but appropriate for the district court to permit additional evidence on the points that were the subject of the remand? That's not the Weiss situation.
Well, I would submit that the Weiss case is very similar to the case that is before this court. It too was remanded. It too was a situation to determine whether uncharged conduct should be relevant conduct.
But the evidentiary status was different, though. It wasn't a situation where a point had simply not been explored earlier. Indeed, as I recall, Judge Posner, but anyway, the opinion makes it clear that the government had its opportunity to introduce evidence, and it was the legal consequences of that needed to be looked at further.
And in this case, the government had the opportunity to present evidence at the first sentencing hearing, and the court did hear evidence.
Not on this point, though. You never raised it. It was forfeited. I mean, so we did go to plain error review, but...
Well, the defendant had a different attorney during the first sentencing hearing.
I'm not trying to be personal about this at all, but I mean, in terms of the legal arguments that we deal with, it had been a forfeited point.
What this court ruled was forfeited was whether the trial court original findings were sufficient to tie the uncharged conduct with the offense of conviction. This court did not rule that the defendant had forfeited a contested matter as to the crack cocaine issue or as to the 198 grams of powder. That had not been forfeited. In fact, the defendant objected to it at the first sentencing hearing in written objections throughout the sentencing hearing, as this court noted originally.
My question is similar, but a little... You see, as Judge Woods has noted, there was a forfeiture by the defendant on this issue. On the other hand, it's always the government's burden to prove relevant conduct by a preponderance of the evidence. And I'm trying to figure out if the government had an opportunity to meet the burden at the first sentencing, even though the defendant didn't raise it.
I would submit that the answer to that is the government did have the opportunity. In fact, during the first sentencing hearing, Judge Gilbert heard evidence from Agent Kirkham, who testified about a post-arrest statement this defendant made, wherein this defendant, according to Agent Kirkham, advised that he had been involved in the distribution of crack cocaine and had been involved in the distribution of powder cocaine. There was evidence on that point. The court heard that evidence. It was subject to cross-examination. And in fact, during the first sentencing hearing, the defendant testified and basically disputed the allegations as to what was in the post-arrest statement. For instance, in the first appellate decision, the panel stated that throughout the first sentencing hearing, Sumner, quote, and this is a quote, Sumner consistently challenged the agent's account of his confession. Also, Sumner challenged, as to the crack cocaine issue, whether there was a temporal gap between the charged conduct and the uncharged conduct. That appeared on page 540 of the first decision. In a written objection to the original pre-sentence report, defendant's first counsel made a wholesale objection to paragraph 24 of the pre-sentence report, and the court may recall that paragraph 24 of the pre-sentence report set out all of the relevant conduct findings that appeared in the pre-sentence report. So the defendant had objected to paragraph 24, which contained the only provisions as to the relevant conduct.
Is Mr. Sumner in prison?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he's been in for over 2 years now? Because as I recall, the difference here would have been something like 8 to 14 months or 121 to 151 months.
That is correct. The first sentencing hearing was held in October of 2000, and he was sentenced to 132 months imprisonment.
Right.
Since that time, he has been in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons. And what we have disputed, and what the first on the first appeal, one of the main issues is whether the crack cocaine should be counted as relevant conduct. And what this court asked the judge to do, the trial judge to do, is to make a specific finding to determine if there was a tie. And we would submit that the findings that were made on the record during the second sentencing hearing are still not sufficient.
As he's what now, 78?
He's 78, ma'am. And he remains in the
Why weren't they sufficient, in your opinion?
For one, the original findings, such as they were by the trial court relied on the assertions found in the pre-sentence report rather than the testimony that was heard at the first sentencing hearing. At the second sentencing
hearing... Can't he do that? Isn't that a matter of his judgment, his discretion?
I would submit that he could not, and we would cite for this notion...
Was that challenged at the pre-sentencing hearing?
It was. I think what originally happened is after the court made the findings as to relevant conduct, counsel was asked whether, or strike that, that's not correct. Counsel failed to make an objection as to those findings. And what we would bring to the court's attention is a 1998 case from this circuit, United States versus Bacallo, B-A-C-A-L-L-A-O, which basically says that if there is a contested issue between charged conduct and uncharged conduct, that the court cannot rely upon an assertion found in the pre-sentence report.
Well, how would he know if there is no objection made?
There was an objection.
I thought you said there wasn't.
There was an objection made.
Not what this court did. What happened at the hearing?
Okay. To begin with, originally, counsel at the first sentencing hearing, prior to it, filed a written objection to paragraph 24 of the pre-sentence report, which set out the relevant conduct finding. However, the trial court ruled, and when the trial court ruled and made the finding as to relevant conduct at the first sentencing hearing and sentenced the defendant to 132 months, counsel did not object. Then this court took up the issue on appeal as to whether that was waiver or forfeiture, and of course the court ruled that it was forfeiture with a remand back to the lower court. So there was an objection made. It was made before the sentencing hearing, but arguably the objection was not preserved, which was a forfeiture issue that this panel previously considered.
Now, didn't the court also rely on quite a few of Mr. Sumner's own statements that he later on wanted to disavow, but wasn't it up to the court to decide which ones to believe?
Indeed. The court found that Agent Kirkham was credible at the first sentencing hearing and that the defendant's testimony was not credible. However, the problem with that is Agent Kirkham's testimony was very vague as to what was in the post-arrest statement. There was no testimony, well, first as to the issue of crack cocaine, because there are two separate issues here. There's the crack cocaine issue and the powder cocaine issue. But as to the first issue of powder cocaine, there was very little by way of knowing when this occurred, when this conduct occurred, where it occurred, and who was involved. As to the powder cocaine issue, all that was known and all that was testified about at the first sentencing hearing is that there was, according to Agent Kirkham, crack dealing by the defendant during 1997, and that about a quarter ounce was sold per week for a two-month period. There was no evidence presented from Agent Kirkham or the government at the first sentencing hearing or second sentencing hearing as to where it occurred, whether others were involved, prices, and that sort of thing. Now, that information did appear in the pre-sentence report. However, the defendant objected to that. And in the findings, the first findings the court made, the trial court, at the first sentencing hearing, the trial court relied on what was found in the pre-sentence report. It also happened in the second report. For instance, this court ruled...
But the court relied on it, saw fit to rely on it.
Relied on what was found in the pre-sentence report,
right,
which the defendant had objected to.
Well, what's wrong with that? That he made that determination.
The Bacallo decision, Your
Honor. Pardon me?
The Bacallo decision. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's the case I mentioned earlier, which basically says if what is found in the pre-sentence report is objected to and contested to at a sentencing hearing, the court may not rely upon that solely for a finding of relevant conduct. That's the, I believe that's the 19, I'm sorry, one moment please. That's the 1998 case from the circuit.
What's that site, please?
149 F3rd, page 717. The spot site would be page 722, Your Honor.
That's from 1998, and it's an F3rd?
Yes, Your Honor, according to my notes. That is the site. Perhaps I'm mistaken on that. If so,
that's how you said it in your brief.
I would welcome the opportunity to be corrected on that. But thank you, Your Honors. I would reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Moore.
Please, the court for the counsel,
Mr. Goggins.
The remand in this case was, as this court noted at the beginning of counsel's argument, a very narrow remand. It was a remand for the purpose of directing the district court to make sufficient findings to support the sentence which was imposed. And while counsel says that the issue of course of conduct was raised. In fact, if you look at the objections which were filed, the objections were all directed at the fact that the defendant took the position that his own statements did not have a sufficient indicia of reliability, and that's where the objections went. It was a question that with regard to the weights comprising relevant conduct based upon the credibility assessment of the district court, whether the agent's testimony as to what was said was accurate or whether the defendant's testimony at the sentencing hearing was accurate. The district court found that the credibility lay with Agent Kirkham, who took the defendant's own statements.
Mr. Moore, let me just ask you this. If you had to rely solely on the evidence that you presented at the first sentencing hearing, was there sufficient evidence there to to find that Mr. Sumner immediately began to sell powder cocaine after he stopped selling crack. In other words, what evidence from the first sentencing hearing supports that finding?
No evidence was taken as to that specific issue because the question was not the temporal proximity, which is really a question of course of conduct. It was rather whether or not he was actually involved in a specific amount of weight. The question of course of conduct was simply not addressed because the objection was not made to course of conduct by the defendant. I think that was the thrust of this court's determination.
Forgive me for interrupting, but are you saying that therefore it wasn't the government's burden to prove the crack was sufficiently related to the offense of conviction? See, what I'm trying to understand is, no matter what, why wouldn't the government have produced all of its relevant evidence at the first sentencing hearing?
Well, the government would produce its relevant evidence as to those issues which were, in fact, in issue, that is, where objections had been raised. Objections had not been raised as to the question of course of conduct. And temporal proximity, which I think Your Honors are relating to at this moment, is a question of course of conduct. And that simply wasn't an issue raised by the defendant.
Let me ask it this way. Let me think for a minute. In what sense was crack an issue before the district court for the first time on remand?
On remand?
Mm-hmm.
On remand, the issue was whether or not the crack cocaine attributed to Mr. Ash, the 56 grams, was part of the same course of conduct. I don't think the issue was crack. I think it was whether or not that particular amount of drugs constituted the same course of conduct. Let me just point out, Your Honor, that defendant concedes that crack that he received back in 1992 is part of the same course of conduct, but now he's saying that the crack he received in 1997, 1998 is not part of the same course of conduct, yet he continues to deal the cocaine, and people are using his house to cook crack cocaine right up to the arrest.
I'll put my cards on the table, because my thought is that the only close issue in this case, okay, is whether the government should have been allowed a second bite at the apple in putting on more evidence related to the crack.
Well, once again, all I can say is that when the first sentencing hearing was held, that was not an issue, because the question was whether or not, which was raised after the fact, whether or not that crack cocaine was part of the same course of conduct. The crack cocaine, and I think any drugs where there is no specific issue as to what we're dealing with here is, now let's see how I want to say this. The issue of weights, which is what was being dealt with in the first sentencing hearing, is different than the issue of course of conduct, which is what I understand this court's remand to have been about. Finding appropriate...
But wasn't it always your burden to prove relevant conduct?
Well, could I just supplement this by asking you whether what you're trying to say is that you only introduce evidence about things that are contested, or that the government put its position down in the PSR and that you were focusing only on those factual assertions in the PSR that had been called into question? Because
well,
if you put down in the PSR that the crack and Mr. Ash and all sorts of other things were involved, that might be different.
Well, I think the PSR found that they were, in fact, that the crack and the powder cocaine were all part of the same course of conduct, and that was not specifically objected to by the defendant.
Okay, but your cards are on the table. You say this is what we say, so it's not like there was nothing before the court on
relevant
conduct.
That's correct. I mean, and I think the court is, in the absence of objection, is certainly entitled to rely on the PSR. Another question?
Did you want to repeat your question?
So does the issue then go to whether the objections that were made to the PSR were sufficiently specific to trigger an obligation by the government to support more assertions than it was trying to support?
Well, when this court sent the case back, it sent it back with directions to Judge Gilbert to make specific findings with regard to the course of conduct.
Right, but I mean the first time around. I mean, I think Judge Rovner's concern is that the government has a burden by a preponderance of the evidence to support the sentence. It's the government's burden to do that, so you can't just put in half of your evidence and not the other half if it's necessary to create the sentence, and part of that was the relevant conduct. But if you had satisfied your initial burden in the original hearing, and then because of all that happened, we thought more needed to be done, and you had never been given an opportunity to introduce your evidence in further support, I guess, is what I'm trying to think of.
Well, it seems
And let me just have one thought. But you don't get a second crack at the apple.
If there's an identity of issue, I think I understand what the court is saying. But it seems to me that we're really dealing with apples and oranges. We're dealing with the issue of whether or not a statement was accurate in terms of weights and whether or not the drugs that we're dealing with now are part of the same course of conduct.
We're dealing with an extremely subtle but unbelievably important to Mr. Sumner, you know, whether this is a life sentence or if he should be out now. Problem is what we're dealing with.
I understand that, Your Honor.
And it isn't really apples and oranges, except that I think, you know, I'm not sure we're all, you know, that you and we are on the same page.
All right. Well, it seems to me that with regard to the Wiss case, where we have a situation where there is complete and thorough litigation of the issues at the first sentencing. And that clearly did not happen in this case, where the case came back for remand on what appears, at least to the government, to be a separate issue, and that is the course of conduct. And the initial litigation dealt with the question of weights and whether or not a statement was made and what witness was to be believed, whether it was going to be the agent or whether it was going to be the defendant's new version of his earlier statement. I would suggest that with regard to the limited issue of whether or not new evidence should have been taken, the government was not provided with either the necessity at the first hearing to present evidence regarding course of conduct because it was not in issue at that point. It had not been objected to. And if the court reviews the objections that were filed, every one of them deals with the question of whether or not the statement has the indicia of reliability. It was a question of whether or not the statement had in fact been made, and the defendant said, no, it hadn't been made, and therefore you shouldn't rely on it, but it didn't deal with the question of whether or not we have the temporal proximity or the similar quantities or the similar location or the regularity and all of those things which...
But you were given an opportunity to put on evidence of the crack, right?
Yes.
Right.
That's correct.
But you say it was not contested when you did put it on.
The question of the weights of the crack were contested only insofar as it was a question of whether or not the defendant had made the statement that he was good for it or had not made the statement. That was the issue that was presented to Judge Gilbert, and he determined that he had made the original statement.
What I'm worried about is that your view of all of this would make with totally irrelevant in almost any situation, because you can always say, well, there was that tiny issue that we didn't have to deal with.
Well, Wiss makes it very clear that the issue that was sent back had been thoroughly litigated in the first instance. I think a fair reading of this court's remand does not indicate that the issue had been thoroughly litigated because the issue simply had not been raised in the posture that it now presents itself. If If you have no other questions, I'll...
Right. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you, Anna.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. 3 points. First, what I think I hear Mr. Morris saying is that the temporal proximity was not argued at the first sentencing hearing, and that's not so. What this defendant testified to is that his crack cocaine dealings occurred in 1992.
Could I ask you, though, whether at the first sentencing hearing, you have the PSR, you have this paragraph 24, and paragraph 24 mentions different drugs and different amounts that the government's assertion are. And had there been no objection at all to paragraph 24, I take it you agree that the district court could have relied on that to support a sentence.
The district court could have relied upon paragraph 24.
So it mentions both crack and powder. It mentions a time period, 1997 through whatever it was, 99. So what we're trying to focus on is whether the exploration of the issues that are asserted in that paragraph 24 was sufficient at the first hearing, such that the government should be precluded from going back and adding to it in the second hearing, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And I would submit the issue is not whether it was thoroughly litigated, as Mr. Moore would have you believe, but rather whether there was an opportunity to litigate it. The defendant testified in his case in chief at the sentencing hearing, I was involved in crack cocaine in 1992. The government had the opportunity to rebut that at the first sentencing hearing. The government could have called a rebuttal witness. The government could have called Agent Kirkham to testify. No, Judge, this is what the defendant originally told me in his post-arrest statement as to dates, times, when, where, how, that sort of thing. It did not happen.
But did the government know that it was supposed to put on its evidence supporting the 97 to 99 period of time? You know, all this other stuff that maybe is there in the record? What would have caused the government to know that had to be explored?
Before the sentencing hearing or during?
In the first time through, when the objections weren't focusing on that.
After the defendant testified, because Agent Kirkham testified at the first sentencing hearing. He was available. He was in the courtroom.
I understand, but if you've met your initial burden of production, you don't usually go on and keep on testifying.
Well, in a situation like this where we have a huge quantity of crack cocaine at issue and the defendant or the government was committed to sentencing this defendant to prison, I would submit that the better course of action is to present all the evidence that the trial judge would allow to come in on the point because the stakes were high here.
Mm-hmm. What are your second and third points?
The defendant did not concede that all of the crack cocaine from 1992, which he testified to, was relevant. Instead, at the first sentencing hearing, what the defendant asserted was that there was only 7 grams of crack cocaine that was could be attributed to him. He did not assert and did not testify that all of the 56 grams were relevant conduct, only a portion.
And your third point?
I think I've already covered it, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will proceed to case